Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Hillary, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequests of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the only campaign management minor in the nation, and over $70,000 in scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, which is www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. Today's Hinckley Forum is who is watching us, who is watching the NSA while it is watching you. And for today's guests, we have our Honorable Judge D. Benson. Just a little bit on our speaker today. Judge Benson is a judge on the United States District Court for the District of Utah. He was a member of the charter class of the J. Reuben Clark Law School in Brigham Young University. Judge Benson spent approximately 8 years practicing with the Salt Lake City law firm of Snow, Christensen, and Martineau. Also, he was appointed the United States District Judge by President George H.W. Bush. And Judge Benson also holds an adjunct law school professorship, and the J. Reuben Clark Law School at Brigham Young University and the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah, and teaches courses of criminal trial practice and evidence. So if everybody will welcome Judge.
Thank you.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate the invitation to say a few words about national security and privacy. And I know this has probably been prompted, at least in part, if not solely, by the recent publicity this topic has been given with the disclosures that were made public by Edward Snowden and then the newspapers in London and Washington, and it spread from there. Back in 2004, I had been a judge about 12 years, and at one point during my judgeship, I might say, because it's always a pleasure to be in the same room with Kirk Jowers, and there was a time when I had two law clerks in a row. They didn't work together, but I can't remember which was first, but Mike Lee was there, and then Kirk Jowers. And so now one is a U.S. senator, which is remarkable to me that somebody that young would get there, and then the other one is Kirk Jowers, who is now the head of this fine institution, body, whatever you call it. I don't know who's more important. I'm always reading, or who's more influential. I'm always reading quotes from both of them. I'm not going to comment on the content of those quotes, but I'm proud of those two law clerks, and as I'm sure all of the students here enjoy being under the direction of Kirk Jowers, and he was even more fun as a law clerk, and so I appreciate him for being here and inviting me. In 2004, I received a telephone call from Chief Justice William Rehnquist, and we weren't exactly friends or acquaintances even. I think I met him when he was going through the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings when he was nominated by President Reagan to be the Chief Justice. I was Chief of Staff to Senator Hatch, and I know I met him, but I didn't think he was calling for a friendly chat, and I wondered what I had done wrong. I'm a little old district judge in Utah, and I'm getting a call from the Chief Justice of the United States. And he got right to the point, and Chief Justice Rehnquist said, "Judge, I'd like to ask you to serve on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. Would you be willing to do that?" And I said, sure. And then I got off the phone, and I turned to whatever law clerk was in the room, and I said, "Look up the Foreign Intelligence something court." And he said, "Why?" And I said, "Because I think I just agreed to be on it." And then he came back a few minutes later with some papers in his hand, and he said, "Do you know what you've gotten yourself into?" And I said, "No." And he said, you know, this is a 7-year assignment, and it's in Washington." And I did not know. For all my work in Washington and my general knowledge that something like this was going on, I really didn't know what I had just agreed to. And the way the Chief Justice was, he didn't really engage in a lot of discussion about what it was. It was just a request from the Chief Justice of the United States, which doesn't happen every day, and I said yes, and it went from there. I had to pass a security clearance, background check, and that took a few months because the FBI is slow, and I said I just did one of these for the judgeship, and they said, well, it doesn't matter. We have to do it all again. And during that time, I read up on the court and the job I'd gotten myself into, and from 2004 to 2011, I was a member of that court. The act which created the court created positions on the court for district judges like me to sit on the court for a term of 7 years without any prospect of renewal. By the time I finished, it's a lot like our grand jurors in federal court. It's an interesting thing. We have grand juries. People come in, and they don't want to be on it. They hear that it's going to be an 18-month assignment, and they're going to meet usually in our district every other week to pass on indictments. And when I was U.S. attorney and now as a judge, I've experienced the same thing, that when they finish, many of the people want to re-enlist. They'd like to do another 18 months. And I felt that same way when I finished my 7 years on the FISA court. Technically, it's not the FISA court, it's the FISC, which is a name I hate. But judges on the court tend to insist on calling it the FISC for Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. But I couldn't re-up, so I was done in 2011, so now I just have memories of it. Everything I did in that job was classified, or everything I handled was based on classified information, so I couldn't read the applications from the Department of Justice for surveillance orders. I couldn't read them on a plane. I couldn't read them in my home office here in Salt Lake. I had to go to Washington, D.C., where I had an office, and next to it was a secured facility for hearings, and all I had to do everything right there in Washington, D.C. So every ninth or tenth week, I would be the only judge on duty to handle all of the applications from the United States Department of Justice, representing the executive branch of government, seeking orders to allow them to surveil people that they found to be involved in primarily espionage activities or terrorist activities. And when I first got there, the act hadn't been amended to the extent it was amended later, and I would entertain maybe 70 or 80 applications many weeks. And we had four and then five attorney advisors who were all very smart in this national security law to help the court and to help me to get me through some of the intricacies of the act. But later on, after the act was amended, it was more on the order of 40 or 50 applications per week. Sometimes the FISA court has been called a rubber stamp for the executive branch. It's not. There is a high percentage of the applications that get approved, something like 99%. So that might lead you to think it's a rubber stamp. I'll say this, though, and I can say this. This isn't classified, but I don't think. I would guess that in my experience, and mine I'm sure was typical because we dealt with the other judges on the court regularly, I would say that on average about once a week I would turn down an application, sometimes two or three. But on average I would say that once a week I would tell the Department of Justice attorneys that this doesn't qualify under the act, I can't sign this. Every time I did that in 7 years, so that's, I was there seven or eight times a year for 7 years, so that's about 50-something weeks, they would withdraw the request. And so it didn't get counted as a turndown. It was just, you need more facts or you need something else in order for this to comply with the law. So if I'd even joke with the Department of Justice attorneys occasionally and say, why don't you just let me turn this down? Because it'll make your stats look better, and no one wants to be turned down. The same thing happens with Title III wiretap warrants in my regular district judge practice, by the way. And if you were to look up statistics for nationwide state and federal courts for wiretap requests, they, too, are being approved at the rate of about 99%. There are very few turndowns. And there, again, if the judge finds that there's something wrong with the application, I'll tell the attorneys. In this case, in the District of Utah, it'll be a United States attorney or an assistant United States attorney. And then rather than get a rejection, it's most often withdrawn. Anyway, today I want to talk about this intersection between privacy rights and national security, because that's what this is all about. It was, in light of this, all this recent news about it, it seemed to me that most of the public doesn't have much of a background or an understanding about what this area is all about. So I thought I'd try to quickly today at least share with you a very basic understanding of what this arena consists of, this, and maybe understand a little better the clash that is inevitable between our privacy rights, which we love as Americans, and rightfully so, and our national security efforts, which includes a lot of the time surveillance of communications. This is the National Security Agency building in Maryland, and as a FISA court judge, I was there several times getting briefed by the general who runs it, and Keith Alexander is still there, and you may, if you've been reading the news in recent, since June, and the Snowden matter, he's been sort of under fire. A lot of people work there, a lot of people doing a lot of things that I don't know exactly what they're doing, but I do know this, they're gathering a whole lot of data, gathering data from foreign sources and also within the United States. So it's an interesting facility, and they're building, as you know, another one out here in Utah and Lehi. So I want to talk about what the situation was that gave rise to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and I'll try to go quick with this. There are probably students in here. There are students who are under, like, 25, under age. Although there are a lot more old people than I expected. But anyway, would some student tell me, after World War II, although it's up there, what was the big evil in America? Communism. I mean, communism was bad. I remember driving down the State Street and seeing a big billboard that had Martin Luther King allegedly in a communist training center. I don't know why I remember that as a kid. I was like in junior high school. If you could, if you wanted to smear someone with a bad reputation, you labeled them a communist. And you know the Joe McCarthy hearings and the question, are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party, was a really, really big deal. Communism was like public enemy number one. And the Soviet Union in all it represented. It's what gave us the Vietnam War. It's, if we think Al-Qaeda is public enemy number one or among them today, I mean, communism, I think, was bigger. And there was a lot of effort by the executive branch of government to figure out who was involved in the Communist Party and what they were up to. So J. Edgar Hoover was the director of the FBI. I don't know how he stayed on through so many terms of so many presidents. President John Kennedy once said he kept Hoover in as FBI director because it was better to have him inside the tent than outside. And there was probably a lot to be said for that, but Hoover was an interesting guy, and I've got a photo of him here. That's our man, J. Edgar Hoover, and he ran the FBI with a almost dictator-like approach. And here is J. Edgar with a Tommy gun. And During the 1940s, after World War II, 1950s, 1960s, and into the 1970s, according to investigations that were done in the 70s, he had at least 11,000 illegal, what were deemed to be, maybe I shouldn't say illegal, warrantless wiretaps of everyday Americans. And people from Marilyn Monroe to Elvis Presley to Martin Luther King, he had a thick file on Martin Luther King, Hollywood directors, celebrities, politicians, anyone that the J. Edgar Hoover in particular and the executive branch of government thought might be up to mischief and especially involved with communism, they got their mail read and their phone calls listened into, and all on an order of the executive branch of government. And that was what went on for decades. And so in the early 70s, a senator from Idaho, Frank Church, who was chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, formed a committee to investigate this matter, and he had hearings that became very famous, and they went on for a while. And at the end of them, found that this practice was widespread. Now, the FBI and the executive branch said, well, it was all necessary to protect us from the threat of communism. And we had to do it, and we defend our practices, but the Congress and the mood of the people was otherwise, and the Senate, this is Frank Church at the hearing, by the way, he lost the next election in Idaho, I think, because they thought he was getting too highfalutin in Washington, D.C., but they decided Congress ought to look in to see how they could correct this problem. In the meantime, this is a quick hit on the law, but I think in order to understand this, you need to know what was going on with the Supreme Court and the law. The Fourth Amendment in the Bill of Rights in the Constitution says that the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. And then on it goes on to discuss warrants. That's the backdrop for what is legal and what isn't legal when conducting searches and seizures. In Olmstead versus United States in 1928, and this was a U.S. Supreme Court that involved some pretty smart men, including one Oliver Wendell Holmes. In Olmstead, you had a bootlegger in New York City who did most of his work through telephones, often public telephones. He was prosecuted and convicted. He complained that the wiretaps of these telephone conversations where the law enforcement agents could hear what he was saying to his other bad guys was done without any warrant. And what do you think the U.S. Supreme Court said? That is not a violation of the Fourth Amendment. That is not a house. That is not a person. It's not a paper. And it's not an effect. And it's not a search. It has to be a physical invasion of one of those specified items in the Fourth Amendment, or it's not a violation of the Fourth Amendment. That may strike us as remarkable today, but it was a Supreme Court opinion, and it was an attempt to be true to the language of the Fourth Amendment. That held up for almost four decades, remarkably. I mean, you go to law school, or if you're in law school, I think it's one of the interesting constitutional periods. For almost four decades, until Katz against the United States came along in 1967, and the U.S. Supreme Court said, essentially, they didn't say it just like this, but we got to get rid of Olmstead. And they said this memorable line, the Constitution protects people, not places. There is, by the way, a decent argument that can be made for Olmstead, and if you want to read it, go read Olmstead. Probably got better things to do, and it's now in the junk heap of history, but still, it took a while. And then they said, now we're going to look at a thing called an expectation of privacy, a reasonable expectation of privacy. And we think phone calls are something that people think are private, and that their government isn't listening in on the phone call. So that happened in 67, and then there was a case called U.S. versus U.S. District Court. Why it was styled that way, I don't know. It's called the Keith case because the district judge was named Keith. I think last name, not first name. But this is an important case in this progression because in 1972, some sort of homegrown terrorists, honest-to-goodness terrorist types, were plotting to overthrow the U.S. government. The FBI got wind of this. J. Edgar Hoover said, we got to listen to all their telephone conversations. And it turns out they were planning to bomb the CIA building in Sacramento, California. I mean, and they, because of the telephone intercepts, which were done without a warrant and done in the name of national security, they were tried and convicted of an attempted bombing of the building. So they took their case to the courts, and the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in this case that the wiretaps were illegal because they were not first, they didn't first get a warrant from a court. And the government yelled long and loud, but it's for national security purposes. There has to be an exception to this Fourth Amendment requirement of warrants in national security cases. We have to have a free rein to go investigate these things, because there's a fundamental difference between national security investigations and criminal investigations. And in national security investigations, you're trying to figure out what is going on out there to prevent something bad from happening. In a criminal prosecution, you're trying to prosecute somebody for having done a criminal act. They're quite different efforts. And in the world as a whole, all the foreign countries, I mean, espionage is not new, and intelligence operatives are not new. And the executive branch's theory was, we don't think we need a warrant when we're conducting national security business. The U.S. Supreme Court, interestingly enough, generally agreed with that. And in the Keith case, recognized that there probably is an exception for national security investigations. But they said not in this case, for one reason only. Because foreign intelligence is one thing, and this involves our own citizens. So you should have had a warrant, and the Keith guys, the Keith defendants went free. So now the Supreme Court had said in a famous footnote in the Keith case, and they actually said this, Congress, I can't remember another time when the Supreme Court said this, maybe Congress ought to get involved and enact a law that recognizes a national security difference. And you can go look it up and you'll see the footnote. And so Congress is just finishing the Church Committee hearings. It's the mid-70s. Watergate's just happening. And they read the Supreme Court opinion. We ought to do something about this. So they did, and that's what created the National or the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, or Act of 1978. And it created the court that I later sat on in 2004. It created this new court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, with seven district judges from around the country who would sit for a seven-year term. And it's fairly simple. And if you really want to care to understand this area, this is key. I've boiled it down to its simplest form, but this is basically it. You can get surveillance for foreign intelligence purposes if you satisfy basically these three requirements. One, you have to be able to show that your target is an agent of a foreign power. A foreign power includes all foreign countries, Russia, for example, or the Seychelles. But if it's a foreign country, it's easy to see. If it's a foreign-based organization like Al-Qaeda, it's going to qualify as well. And bear in mind, when this was adopted, the big evil was still communism. Terrorism was mentioned, but we didn't even know what terrorism was in the United States in the mid-70s. Not really. We hadn't been afflicted by it like we are now. But you had to have a target. You didn't need to know his or her name, but you needed to know some identifying factors about this person that you want to surveil. And then you can, and if so, if you've got an agent of a foreign power, for example, let's say that in the Russian embassy in Washington, D.C., there are people working there. say just the lowliest of clerical workers, they qualify as an agent of a foreign power. When they come over here, they know that their telephones are being listened to, or probably. And when we go to Russia, we know the same thing. But the second one is you have to identify what facilities you're going to go up on. You need to be able to satisfy a simple test that this target is using something like a telephone or an apartment or a hotel room or a computer sending emails, and or he is about to use it. And then why? And the act required that it had to be solely, you had to certify, the executive branch had to certify that this is solely for foreign intelligence gathering activities. So that was the act that was passed from 1978 until 9/11. It was a fairly sleepy operation in Washington. The judges went back every other week for 2 days. I've talked to some of them that were on the court then. A friend of mine from Oklahoma, he said it was a wonderful thing. He had a son who was working for the FBI, and it's right across the street from where the FISA court used to be. And he said it was great. I'd go back and sit around with my son, and I'd handle maybe 4 requests every other week for 2 days. But that changed. Everything changed with 9/11 when those buildings got bombed. And every president since Carter through George W. Bush, including significantly a robust effort by Clinton, was to get more powers so he could go after people like Osama bin Laden. Because 9/11 was such a devastating thing, and it brought to our attention the serious menace of terrorism, which had replaced communism, and it's interesting how that happened, too, but we were trying to help al-Qaeda beat the communists in Afghanistan. Little did we know we were arming our next enemy. But that caused the Patriot Act to be passed, and it did a number of things to give the executive branch a little more power and authority in this area to conduct foreign intelligence. I'm only going to focus on a couple because they get the most attention. The first was, as I said earlier, the act required the intelligence gathering to be solely for foreign intelligence purposes. You could not use it for criminal prosecutions. And if you go back and listen to the 9/11 hearings or the report that was delivered, one of the biggest problems was this separation, this wall between law enforcement use of FISA information, which is easier to get than a probable cause warrant in a criminal case. I hope you notice that distinction. In a criminal case, you have to show probable cause that you've got a bad guy who has committed a crime or is in the process of committing a crime. Then you can go up on his phone. But it's important that he is or is about to commit a crime, like attempted bombing or homicide or rape or whatever it is that this person is in the middle of planning or plotting. But for a FISA warrant, you just need probable cause that this person is an agent of a foreign power. This person is a member of al-Qaeda. That's enough. It's just enough. It's who they belong to. They belong to a foreign power. So the Patriot Act dismantled that wall of separation between law enforcement and foreign intelligence gatherers. One of the most memorable pieces of evidence in the 9/11 hearings after it happened to figure out what happened was an FBI agent who could document that if the half the side of our house that knew about, I've forgotten his name, Masui or something, who was, they had information on, some of you would know better than I remember the name, on his computer, if we could have shared that, if the criminal guys could have shared that with the foreign intelligence national security guys, it might have prevented 9/11. So, but during the Janet Reno administration and those preceding her, but hers especially, the wall was considered absolutely inviolate. You couldn't share information from one side of the house to the other. So it took that wall down, and it also has this somewhat controversial provision to some, allowing the executive government to obtain business records. That could be library records, that could be records from Verizon, that could be records from any institution that keeps records on communications that people have with each other. And the only thing you need to present to the FISA court is a certification from a high-ranking executive branch official, such as the Attorney General, the Deputy Attorney General, that this relates to an ongoing foreign intelligence gathering investigation. It just needs to be relevant to a foreign intelligence gathering investigation. But that data is limited to a thing called metadata, which is key to understanding, I think, this whole process. This is an example of metadata. We just pulled this up on the internet. This has nothing to do with anybody here. It was a 1919 letter, and it's sent to a guy named Lieutenant Daniel Hill, and from Mayhill, might be his mother, might be his aunt, you don't know, and it has a postmark there, Washington, D.C. As I said, 1919, you've got a January 6th, 3, 5 p.m. You got a lot of information there. It's all metadata. It is on the outside of the envelope. You're not into the inside of the envelope. And the Patriot Act allowed the government to obtain all the metadata that they felt was pertinent to a national security investigation. Totally different from content. This is content. To get inside that letter, you need to go to that full FISA. To me, when I was a FISA judge, and say, I've got a target who is an agent of a foreign power, and I want to look into his mail. I want to look into his email. I want to listen into his telephone conversations, and I want to hear what he's discussing with other people. The invasion of privacy, when you get into content, is a whole different thing than metadata. And this is an invasion. See how much fun they're having? The metadata would not be all that exciting here, I suspect. And I don't want the content, but the content really, really matters. And it's a huge distinction. And when I was on the court, I recognized that sometimes the government would come in, and this isn't classified because it's so general, and it's all been discussed since Snowden anyway, and they would want to have orders granting them to go up and seize vast amounts of data from telephone companies and other organizations. And when I would ask why, they said, well, because these companies they're not really comfortable giving it to us without a court order, for one thing, because we could probably do this under a thing called a national security letter, but that's something else again. But we want a court order. Ever since Katz versus United States, it's been important to think that we've got an independent tribunal in a court who's blessing this stuff, an independent assessment of, do you really need this? And I would sometimes say, well, why do you want all that? And they'd say, well, they could destroy it, and they may not give us to us without a court order, and we're entitled to it under the Patriot Act. And then if that was the case and they met the requirements of the Act, I would sign the order. That, by the way, maybe getting ahead of myself, is what the Snowden stuff, as I've learned about it, and I've only learned what you have in the newspapers, that's what it's been all about. Not content information, but metadata. This stuff. Two things have happened since the Patriot Act was passed after 9/11 that have put the FISA court into the major headlines of America. In 2006, when I was on the court, maybe some of you remember President Bush's domestic warrantless program. And I remember getting an emergency call to go back to Washington because we got a problem. And it was the only time I had my 15 minutes of fame. I thought it was a big deal because everybody in America wanted me to be on their news program. Nightline offered to fly me wherever I wanted to go. I thought it was a big deal till Ron pointed out, they said, yes, tell Judge Benson we'll fly her anywhere that she wants to go. So they just wanted any FISA court judge who would agree to actually go talk to them, and none of us did, what George W. Bush really was doing was bypassing the FISA court and getting all this metadata through decisions made within the NSA. That's really what it boils down to. And I still remember the director of the CIA, Michael Hayden, briefing us, and I finally hit my head. Why does it take all afternoon to tell me that this is metadata? First of all, I had never really been acquainted with the word. You keep saying metadata. What is that? He showed me an envelope, and I finally got it. I said, okay, so you go to Sprint, you say, we want all your phone records. Well, it will show. And they do this for business purposes. Sprint has all these things. Anyway, it shows, you know, who made a call from what number to what number, how long it lasted, and now you can get information about where, sometimes from pings off of cell towers, where it was made from. It's all non-content information. If you get into content, then you got a problem. And the law can get technical. There's a thing called post-cut-through digits, which, has anybody heard of post-cut-through digits? Because metadata is like, let's say I call my pharmacist. That's metadata that's going to be show up in Sprint or whoever's got my telephone records. And the NSA can get that fairly easily through a FISA order. By the way, after the Bush thing got all blown up and a lot of publicity, the NSA started going through the FISA court religiously on this stuff after that. And President Bush's defense was, I started doing this shortly after 9/11, and I thought it was such an emergency, and the FISA court's just too slow sometimes. Well, you have emergency authority in the hands of the Attorney General, and I don't know, and we are slow sometimes. But anyway, back to post-cut-through digits. Do I call my pharmacist? Maybe. And I'm just making this up, but if I do, I get a recording. This is push button one, you know, if you're refilling your opioid prescription. So, you know, I push one. Well, they've got some content. I mean, you go pull this up in the legal cases, it still hasn't been resolved. The courts are all over the place in post-cut-through digits. It seems to me that once you got any kind of content about what my call was about, you're in the content, and you're going to need a full FISA. Which isn't that hard to get, but you at least have to have a probable cause that someone is an agent of a foreign power or that they are aiding and abetting, knowingly, an agent of a foreign power. Anyway, the 2006 incident and then the 2013, a couple of months ago when Edward Snowden, who was working for a contractor that was involved with the NSA data collection process, decided that he didn't like the fact that all this information was being gathered on Americans, apparently, from what his account is in the newspapers. And so he turned this over to the Guardian newspaper in London and the Washington Post. And you got headlines that were like these. NSA collecting phone records of millions of Verizon customers daily. Top secret court order requiring Verizon to hand over all call data shows scale of domestic surveillance under Obama. New leak indicates Britain and U.S. track diplomats. And the newspaper, and he gave us some like cartoons. It got a lot of news. I wonder what civil libertarians think of us now. Pull up their email accounts and let's have a look. It's interesting how quickly we go from thinking that metadata is content. And it is. I was up in Idaho, Frank Church's territory, doing handling a case a couple of weeks ago after this happened. These are the kind of headlines. USA Today, NSA admits new privacy violations. Thousands with no ties to terror watched. And the way the media portrays this is that this is a huge problem and that the government is spying on all of us. And from my background, and I was just as curious as anybody, I wanted to read these newspaper articles and these media reports carefully to see, are we misusing content And that's a very important question to me, because that would get us back to the J. Edgar Hoover days, when it was rampant and it was clearly abusive and wrong. I've talked to an occasional senator or congressman on this when they wanted just some general knowledge about the Patriot Act and not for my political view, but just some education on it. And I say, well, I think this. If I ever hear of a story where some NSA official or any official in the executive branch has actually gone in and grabbed some content from a communication that wasn't authorized and has misused it, say to blackmail somebody having an affair or something, then I am really going to be bothered. And then my main focus then will be, how are we going to correct the internal policing policies and regulations of the NSA or whatever organization it was that was allowing an FBI or anyone else, somebody to have that kind of access to information. The Snowden, I'll finish with this, the Snowden affair I found intriguing. The public reaction is always fascinating to me. There was a former deputy director of the National Counterterrorism Center in Washington named Andrew Lightman, who I worked with, who wrote a Los Angeles Times op-ed piece, which I think, generally speaking, has some important points. He says in it that incidents like the Snowden affair put my former colleagues in the intelligence community in an impossible situation. Yes, the official explanations about the virtues of data collection efforts can sound self-justifying and vague, but they're still right. I know firsthand that General Keith Alexander, the NSA director, is telling the truth when he talks about plots that have been preempted and attacks that have been foiled because of intelligence his agency collected. I know, because I was on the inside. He said, I find the controversy so frustrating. I realize many Americans don't trust their government. I wish I could change that. I wish I could tell people the amazing things I witnessed during 30 years in the CIA, that I've never seen people work harder or more selflessly. And I would add that to my experience with the FISA court. I wish every American could see how dedicated and devoted that court is, and those attorney advisors and the judges who are there to upholding that act of Congress. But he said, but I've been around long enough to know that deep-rooted distrust of government is immune to stories from people like me. The conspiracy buffs are too busy howling in protest at the thought that their government could uncover how long they spent on the phone with their dear aunt. Let me break this to you gently. The government is not interested in your conversations with your aunt, unless, of course, she's a key terrorist leader. More than 100 billion emails were sent every day last year. 100 billion every day. In that vast mass of data lurk a few bits that are of urgent interest and vast terabytes that are not. Unfortunately, the metadata, so he's using the word now, the phone numbers, length of contact, and so forth, but not the content of the conversations that sketch the contours of a call to your family member, may fall into the same enormous bucket of information that includes information on the next terrorist threat. As Jeremy Bash, the former chief of staff of the CIA, memorably put it, if you're looking for a needle in the haystack, you need a haystack. So you boil it down, and yeah, I think the NSA out here in Lehi is going to have huge volumes of data from phone companies and other places. But I think the system isn't a bad one. And I think the present hue and cry should be investigated. And I think it's good to call for a national discussion on this. During this whole process, the only thing that really bothered me was that the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, who I know and I think is a decent guy, but a great guy, but he testified before a congressional committee and he was asked point blank, the NSA collecting, like, all Americans' phone records? And he said no. Now, he defends that by saying, well, what could I do? I'm in a public congressional hearing. If I say yes, well, then we tell our enemy one of these data collection processes that we're developing. I think, well, you probably should have asked for a closed-door session or something, or told them beforehand, don't ask me that question. Let me talk to the intelligence committees. Plus, I don't know how bad it is for the world to know that we have that capacity. I don't know. I know that when we got good at intercepting cell phone messages, Osama bin Laden stopped using them. In fact, it was rumored that he was using carrier pigeons because we couldn't figure out how to intercept them. So, I don't know. The bad guys are looking to see what we know, and that's the big cry now, that we've told the bad guys that we collect telephone records. Well, didn't they know we might do that? But anyone who had an understanding of the Patriot Act going into this would know that that act allows this to be done, this kind of metadata collection. And it's, I think, fair to, if you think that's overdone, to seek a change for the law, but not to blame the National Security Agency. And I suppose you could always quibble about what's good policy, and that could be an ongoing and almost endless debate. I've probably taken too long. I'd be glad to entertain any questions you have. Yes, sir. Oh, hold on just a second. She says, am I over time? Okay, apparently I'm a little premature on questions, so hold that, and the dean of the library is coming up.
Yeah, so I just wanted to introduce Dean Commerce. She is the new dean for the Marriott Library. They are the ones that are co-sponsoring this event in order to get this great information today for the forum. And just a little bit, Alberta Comer, dean of the J.W. Willard Marriott Library and University Librarian, came to the University of Utah in August. Previously, Dean Commerce served as the head of the Circulation Department, acting dean, interim dean, and most recently, dean at the Cunningham Memorial Library in Indiana State University. Dean Commerce's library experience is extensive and diverse. She has worked in the library in Oklahoma. She also served an internship with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and Dean Commerce holds a Master of Library Science degree from Indiana University, Bloomington. So if we could have her... Sorry, I was like, where'd you go? Hi.
So, thank you. I'm going to make this fast because I know you have a lot of questions, and it was a wonderful talk. Thank you for giving that. I noticed some of you are taking notes. I want you to take one more note. The Marriott Library is there for you. Come on over and see us. We're happy to help you in any way that we can, and I'm going to cut it there because I want to let Judge Benson get back to the questions. Thank you.
All right, so now we're going to do questions. Raise your hand if you have a question. I will hand you the microphone, and if you could please state your first and last name clearly into the microphone, that would be great. And
okay, and bear in mind everything you check out from the library, NSA is going to know about. Okay, yes, sir.
My name's...
I had called on him earlier, so I think in fairness, I ought to... get it now, and then we'll go to you. Thanks. You had just started when I jumped the gun. Yes, sir.
Sorry, it feels like karaoke right now.
Well, sing something then.
My question is for the NSA. Is there any difference between the NSA, FBI, CIA? Because I feel like all these organizations that I just mentioned are all in the business of espionage.
Before 9/11, the FBI was primarily a domestic police force, national. Since 9/11, it has altered its mission considerably. Over half of FBI agents now are dedicated to counterterrorism operations. They're focused on domestic-based activities. CIA, by its own charter, is focused on overseas activities. So there is that distinction. But you're right, NSA, FBI, CIA, DIA, which is the Defense Intelligence Agency, and they're all involved in foreign intelligence gathering. You want to call it espionage. That's what they're doing. Yeah. Yes, sir.
My name is Pete Ashdown, and I'm probably one of the few people in this room that has actually received a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court warrant.
You mean Ben, the recipient of one?
Yes.
Well, congratulations.
You yourself mentioned that you would like to see the public see the operations of this court.
No, I said if they could.
If they could,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's
fair. And you yourself mentioned that we have faced greater threats, foreign threats in this country, than terrorism.
Well, we thought we did.
What justifies a secret court with secret proceedings and secret orders which cannot be talked about by the recipients? What in terrorism justifies that, that wasn't justified in the past?
Well, if I might ask, yours must not have been that secret if you know about it.
Yeah, and I couldn't talk about it with my attorneys. I could look
How did you find out about it?
They gave it to me. I wasn't the subject of the warrant. I was the one who processed the warrant.
Oh, to hand over information you had? No. Well, that was probably done pursuant to either the original FISA Act or the Patriot Act. In your question, what can justify a secret court doing secret things?
Why is the trust of the American people so low, right?
Yeah, I think that generally speaking, we don't trust our government, and we jump very quickly to thinking they're going to misuse the information. As for a secret court, I think there's a good debate that could be had on whether we need a FISA court, whether we could just let the executive branch government do what it felt was reasonable under the Fourth Amendment in conducting national security investigations, and then having those argued before the courts, and have the district courts and the circuit courts of appeal and the Supreme Court give us guidance over time of what's allowed and what isn't allowed. But all courts are secret when we're dealing with these kinds of issues. I mean, criminal investigations are no different. A prosecutor coming in for a wiretap order in a criminal case is just as secret by its very nature. I don't even know how you'd have the other side there. You don't call the drug dealer and say, we're going to have a hearing on whether we should issue a wiretap to go up on your phone. He'd probably have some opposition to that and wouldn't use the phone ever again. So it's surreptitious by its very nature. I thought about that sometimes when there are some things that are adversarial. The ACLU has tried everything it can to challenge certain activities of the FISA court and have prevailed a couple of times, as you probably know. So where it seems appropriate to let people know what you're doing, then it could be less secret. But until that happens, I don't know what a way around. That would be like saying espionage can't be secret. Its very nature is secret. And so I don't know. And here's the hardest thing about it is you kind of got to trust the government. And we know what happened with J. Edgar Hoover when we were trusting him. We know where it went. So, you know, your point's... It's not an easy one, but I think it does help if we know what's happening. You're next. Sorry.
Hi, my name is Vivian Nguyen, and the founders kind of have anticipated the spread of technological advancement because to them privacy was within the four physical walls of your home. But now things are wireless and information is everywhere. So how do we draw a bright line on privacy, especially now that the Supreme Court is trying to balance privacy and national security?
Well, we don't draw a bright line on privacy. We try to examine what people in our present-day society have as a reasonable expectation of privacy, and then we let that get invaded. Only in a criminal case, if you get a warrant based on probable cause, so we can listen in on people's private conversations, or in the national security arena, if you have information that the person is an agent of a foreign power or that they are knowingly assisting an agent of a foreign power. So the requirements are very clearly set out. So otherwise, your privacy rights theoretically should not be violated. Now, do I call on these people or do you?
One more question.
Okay. Yes, you can hand it to whoever you want. This gentleman has had his hand up for a while.
Judge Benson, I work in. My name is Steve Corbettaro. I work in information technology here at the university, and I've been on the ground in Russia, China, and Latin America, and I understand the threats. The question, though, really is when the FISA Act was passed, most intelligence techniques were really very distributed and targeted. You might bug a safe house where the Soviet agents were operating in Northern Virginia. But now with these large databases and essentially achieving a centralization of all intelligence information, you really have the much greater potential for misuse. And I think that's what's troubling people now. Do you think that the interpretation of the law or perhaps the law itself should be changed to recognize the fact that we've really got a very large pool that can be misused?
Well, I don't make laws. I just try to interpret them and apply them. But I don't see anything that needs to be changed. On the legal construct, I think it's fair. The two ways we can get into people's private communications. What I do think needs a lot of tending to is that we have policies and procedures in place that make sure we don't have that return to what J. Edgar Hoover was doing. Just willy-nilly, on anybody's whim, go in and listen on somebody's conversation. I think the law's pretty good. I just hope people aren't misusing it. Like Edward Snowden, some people think he's a hero, but I think, well, he just stole classified information and turned it over to newspapers, and they published it. I mean, I think that has been good for generating a public discussion about this, but I don't know, you've got to have safeguards so that doesn't happen. The very thing he's complaining of, that's why I go back to, if I hear of a content invasion for a non-national security purpose, then we got a real problem. Then maybe we need to change the law, or we at least need to change the internal mechanisms to keep that information safe. Am I done? Thank you very much.
So I just wanted to thank you for the great forum. Again, thank you everybody for attending and the Marriott Library for co-sponsoring this day and then providing lunch from the Hinckley Institute and the library. I hope everybody enjoyed this, and one more time, help me with another hand for...